Morning, I'd like to talk about the self and the true self and what we mean by those words from a number of different perspectives. I'll try to touch a little bit on what I covered last week from Hegel, something about the psychoanalytic self, and then what we mean or contrast those with in Buddhism. It's notoriously difficult to pin down the meaning just of the self because people use it in so many different ways. But I could start by saying, I'm Barry. And then the question would be, do you know who I am? In the same way that I know who I am. See that their self is immediately two-sided, Janet face, right? There is my inner experience of being me, what it's like to be Barry. And then there's the Barry that interacts with all of you, who gives talks and enters into relationships. And we create a potential dilemma when we ask about the relationship between those two things. What does it mean for you to know me? Can you ever know me, right? Is it the case that you only know the outer me, the social self, and that the inner me is somehow separate and unknowable to anybody but me, right? There you create this division of the self as the social actor versus the inner self, or maybe that's the true self, as what's subjectively experienced by the person rather than the self that's objectively known by its characteristics and deeds to the outer world. One of the things that Kant and Hegel talked about was the difference between us as knowing creatures from how things seem to us, how they were for us, versus how things are in themselves, right? This, you know, they both suggested that self-consciousness or awareness is characterized by coming to see that we have a perspective on the world, right? That rather than imagining the world is simply open and available to us, that our senses, touch, taste, sound, give us immediate and direct information about the world, the way the world is, we start to get the idea that our senses only bring us part of the information of the world, right? That a dog hears things that we don't hear. Insects see the world differently than we do. But also that a man's take on a situation may be different from a woman's. Or people these days see things differently than they did when in the time of the ancient Greeks. So you get this whole notion of perspective. And in Kant, he felt that all we can ever know is our, actually know is our perspective, the way things are for us, the way things are in themselves, was essentially another world that is impossible to have access to. Hegel took that idea of perspective, but made it his task to say, how do we bring these two things together? He rejected the idea that the world in itself
would Barry.
Yes.
I can't hear you.
No?
Are you muted somehow?
No, I can hear him.
No, I can hear Barry.
You can hear him?
Yeah, we can all hear Barry.
Yeah, I can hear him also.
Just you, Hope. That's an example of what I was talking about. With this whole problem of perspective and how things are for you versus how they actually are. Right? Is this any better? Can you hear me?
No, Hope's phone is muted, it says. You need to unmute your phone.
Well, I hope she's able to get back, but I think I need to continue. Are you with me, Hope? Can you hear me? No? Well, I'm sorry. I'm not sure.
I cannot hear you yet.
But everybody else can?
I don't know if other people can.
Looks like it's good for everybody else, so the problem must be on your end. I'm sorry. Don't know what I can do about that. In any case, we have this dilemma of do we actually know the way things are? Or do we only have our perspective on the world? And then we turn that question around and say, how well do we know ourselves? Or do we only have kind of imperfect perspective on who we are ourselves? From some accounts, how things feel to me is the only true knowledge I have. But then you get the idea that there are parts of myself that are hidden from myself. This is basically a part of the what brings about the revolution of psychoanalysis, the idea that we're not transparent to ourselves. And in Freud, you have the idea that the unconscious is full of repressed, unknowable or unsayable desire. In Bromberg, you have the idea that dissociation means that one part of ourself may not be aware of what another part is doing, maybe ever, that those splits may be very powerful, and that we cannot tolerate the conflict that full awareness would bring about. So we keep these different parts of ourselves compartmentalized. And so that we get different versions of the idea that there's a self that's immediately known to us and a self that is hidden, or aspects that we can't see or recognize. And we then attribute lots of different attributes to these hidden parts. It's different narratives about why they're hidden. Now, as I say, the Freudian picture of the hidden parts of themselves says that those parts are hidden because they're unacceptable to the conscious mind, that we don't want to face them. So there, the real me of the unconscious is all the stuff I don't want to face about myself. It's basically negative, right? And I think that very typically in the realm of therapy, what we encounter is that that's a kind of sort of implicit theory that people carry around about themselves, that there are parts of themselves that they are embarrassed about or afraid of, and that they, one way or another, keep hidden, either from themselves or from everybody else. And if you're afraid of or ashamed of your anger or your sexuality, and you keep that hidden, then you have the subjective experience of putting on a front to the world, a social self that excludes the anger or excludes the sexuality. And the social self then feels like a facade to you. And your true self is this becomes the self you're ashamed of, precisely because you've buried these parts. They become the real thing that no one is allowed to see but you, and even you don't want to face all the time. So in that kind of scenario, which I think is really the most common, we treat our true self as something we're afraid or ashamed of, and that the process of therapy is something that tries to excavate what's been buried and allow it to see the light of day, and to try to understand the history by which we came to be afraid or ashamed of it. In Bromberg's terminology, rather than a depth model, a vertical model, we talk about different self states or different parts of the selves, and we sort of say, can we offer each one of them a seat at the table so that there's some way they learn to coexist with each other, that we no longer treat the parts that are ashamed as the real me. They just become one of many me's, right? That the fact that it's buried hasn't given it any privilege or priority to being real. Once we bring it out or admit to it, it just becomes one part of many parts of who we are. In that sense, it's goes from being the hidden true self to being simply one more aspect of our ordinary self. It's just one self state among many. In Buddhism, true self means something different, but it, in different traditions, it takes on different connotations. There are some traditions in which the true self gets identified with the inner, or with pure awareness, that perceiving, aware consciousness that is imagined to somehow exist apart from its contents, right? In that kind of model, the self in the ordinary sense is both the social self and the mind that's full of its ordinary thoughts and feelings. But that the true self is that mind stripped down to its most pure substrate of awareness without contents, right? Sometimes you get the image of a mirror, just the pure mirror without anything reflected in it, the empty mirror. No dust on it, but nothing in it. It's what is your mind before it begins to think, before it feels anything, before it perceives anything. When we have that kind of model of the true self as pure awareness, we tend to use meditation to pursue a clear, empty mind. We think that what's supposed to happen in our sitting is that thoughts all go away and that we sit in pure silence with a mind like an empty, clear sky that nothing defiles. And I think the problem with that model is not that you can't achieve it, but that you can achieve it some of the time. You can train yourself to empty your mind out in that way, and that may feel quite extraordinary, quite special, and even quite blissful and relieving. But the problem is you can't stay there, and your thoughts come back, and your feelings come back, and your body comes back, and then all these things become dust on your mirror. And in a sense, you become... Meditation becomes a process of ever failing purification or a struggle of the mind against itself to relieve itself of its contents. This, I think, is a dead end. And we have to find another way of thinking about self and true self. See, these different ways of talking about it so far all have in common that they take the self and the true self to be two different things, right? They're all models in which the self is superficial or outer, and the true self is somehow inner and different. And that what we're trying to do is to get through the layer of self down to the depths of true self. But that model, I would say, is the problem. Right? That as soon as we make a distinction between ourself and our true self, we've already gotten ourselves into the very deeper into the very problem we're trying to deal with. See that the problem is essentially, who am I? And where do I look for the answer? When we give our beginners instruction, we say, face the wall as if you're facing the mirror. Your face automatically appears. Which self is that? Is that your ordinary self? Or is that your true self? Right? Where's the difference then? Right? one way we can understand what Buddhism tells us about the true self is that it's not a separate entity that we're cultivating or uncovering, but the true self is our ordinary self properly seen, right? Buddhism tells us that everything just as they are is empty and interdependent. Empty in that it has no unchanging essence. It's always evolving. Interdependent, what it is always context dependent, relationally dependent. Empty and interdependent are not things that we have to strive to become, right? Those are things that we already are, whether we know it or not, or whether we resist it or not. We can say in some sense that ordinary self, for itself, the ordinary self in its own mind, from its own perspective, imagines itself to be solid, unchanging, and independent. Right? Who I am is the me inside. That corresponds to the idea of for itself. Right, that's my perspective on myself. But what I am in myself, corresponding to the thing in itself, right, how it actually is, separate from the perspective, is impermanent and interdependent. It's not a different thing, but it's how I already actually am, whether I realize it or not. So our true self is what I already am all the time, moment after moment. It is simply me moment after moment, whether I know it or not. Moment after a moment, I am perfectly expressing this dharma of impermanence and interdependence. I can't help that. I can't be or do anything other than that. The transformation is not discovering a true self behind myself. It's seeing my ordinary self correctly, as it actually is, as the true self, right? That's what we can call realization, the collapse of any distinction between self and true self. That's what we mean by ordinary mind. Ordinary mind is the way, says that this ordinary mind, this ordinary self, is inseparable from the way, inseparable from the Dharma, inseparable from the true self. This is what I mean when I say nothing is hidden. See, the true self is not something deep inside that we've got to uncover. The true self is the self we already are, just seen from that perspective of emptiness. All right, I think I've made this as clear as I'm going to for right now, and perhaps I'll wait for the discussion to clarify it any further. I'll leave it there. Thank you.